This is the Monday, July 10th, 2017 episode of The History Author Show. Visit our iHeartRadio channel or subscribe on iTunes to enjoy a brand new episode every Monday morning.
Oh, New York ain't New York anymore. How I miss those old pals of mine. The sawdust is gone from the floor where we harmonize, sweet Adeline. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular guys. Oh, New York ain't New York anymore.
Hello and welcome. I'm your host, Dean Karyanis, and this is the History Author Show on iHeartRadio. This week, our time machine welcomes aboard bank robbers Bonnie and Clyde, years before their bullet-riddled fate in 1934. Just who were these two people as individuals, before they melted into an infamous duo that was romanticized in film, stories, and songs? Well, it's swell that you asked. We'll dive into Bonnie Parker's origin story this week in Becoming Bonnie, a novel that boasts, quote, the crash of the century when Bonnie met Clyde. We'll get to know Bonnie during her wholesome, hardscrabble upbringing, leading to the day Clyde enters the picture. And we'll see how she becomes a gangster's moll. Inviting us to ride shotgun on this journey is debut novelist Jenny L. Walsh, a longtime advertising copywriter and, as she describes herself at jennylwalsh.com, lover of Swedish fish candies. You can visit her website to learn more about the author and about her journey to writing about Bonnie and Clyde, or you can follow her on Twitter at Jenny L. Walsh. That name is spelled Jenny with an I. Okay, now that we've climbed into that 1930s car and asked, hey, where are the seatbelts on this thing? Let's meet Jenny L. Walsh and experience Becoming Bonnie. I'm joined via Skype by author Jenny L. Walsh, who brings us the novel Becoming Bonnie. Thanks for making time to chat with the History Author Show.
Thank you for having me.
The first line of Becoming Bonnie is a quote by William Butler Yeats. It's the line, "But I, being poor, have only my dreams." Authors may agonize over their opening words. They might spend months poring over them, deciding what that right hook is, or sometimes that perfect line hits them like a bolt of lightning, and then they have to worry about writing the whole rest of the novel or the rest of the book. So I wonder, what kind of first line was this, and why did you choose it?
It's actually not my initial opening line. When I first wrote the book, I had Bonnie beginning in church, and I wanted to show her boisterous congregation and the pastor talking to her in the crowd and her singing in the choir and to create this wholesome feel. And my editor really liked the opening, but she was also curious more so into Bonnie's life at home as well. So we ended up adding a scene prior to the church scene where we open in Bonnie's home and she's getting ready for church. And as she's getting ready, her long-term boyfriend stops by and he brings with him this notice from the electric company where they're essentially going to turn off Bonnie's home's electric. And that line was relating very much to the fact that her family lives in poverty. But even though they do, Bonnie is determined to almost contradict the line by Yeats where it says, "But I, being poor, have only my dreams." And Bonnie is determined to have both dreams and money. So that line kind of developed as the scene was developing because I was trying to find some type of literature that Bonnie would use to inspire herself because Bonnie is very much into literature and writing poetry and reading novels herself. So I think that line jumped at me and I was like, okay, there we go. That's how I'll begin the novel to really set Bonnie's mindset.
I like to talk with novelists about some of these strings that you don't see as the casual reader, but that are so important to build a good story, especially since, unlike a nonfiction book, there are some things that we don't want to give away. I usually try to stop at maybe 75, 80% of the book so that we don't give it all away. I don't accidentally blurt out the end, although people do know how Bonnie and Clyde end up in this case.
Yes.
You chose to write Becoming Bonnie in the first person present tense. Why that choice? And did you ever consider different styles or another narrator? Talk about that give and take with your editor and other people who advised you when you told your title character's story.
Yeah, so I wanted to write a very immersive story. And I think a lot of different tenses and third person, they can be immersive. But for Bonnie's story, since she's the title character, it's her evolution. I thought that her telling it in first person would be the strongest and would allow readers to slip inside her head and experience things as she's experiencing it. And I think present tense also lends to the ability of going through the experiences as Bonnie is. And that was really important to me. I think a lot of times with past tense, you're telling the story after the fact. And it works great, I think, in stories like thrillers. But for this type of story, I really wanted to have the reader along for the ride, essentially. I don't think there was ever really a doubt who I wanted the story to be told as far as voice. There is a very other strong voice in the novel, which is Bonnie's best friend, Blanche. And she's sassy and fun, and I had a blast writing her. But I think as far as allowing a reader to quickly understand what the story is about, it's easiest just to say that it's Bonnie's story told in Bonnie's voice, opposed to Bonnie's best friend is telling the story about Bonnie.
Also, you're writing period dialogue here, and that requires a light touch, a special touch. You don't want Becoming Bonnie full of so many jeepers creepers that readers start rolling their eyes or it takes you out of the moment. But also, you clearly did a lot of research, and as a writer, you want to put a lot of that in there. Fortunately, with the advent of things like Twitter, where you're very active under your handle, Jenny L. Walsh, you're able to maybe trick yourself or convince yourself, hey, I have some great background stuff, some great pictures, a great story. I could still share that in some medium with the readers. It doesn't have to all be in the book. But I wanted to touch on that and how you researched the 20s and decided just the right way to use the slang and dialect and feelings and descriptions that you clearly had in a big pile at home after researching it.
Yeah, my editor and I kind of established this rule that if we could get specific about the time period, let's do it. Like if I could name a certain type of shoe or a song and include those lyrics, or there's different foods of the time period, like if I can be specific, let's be specific. But we also wanted to balance the fact, as you said, that we don't want people to roll their eyes and think that this is, we're just name dropping left or right. So I think I just really let my characters almost tell me when it was time to include some of the terms, like such as Jeepers Creepers. We are not short of excellent and fun terms and dialogue elements from the 1920s. There are some great turns of phrases.
Yeah.
So I had my pick, and I really wanted to just make sure that if I were to include the word, it would sound natural coming out of my character's mouth. And if it didn't, it didn't make the cut. There's a lot of terms that I would have loved to use, but it felt awkward because I wasn't sure how I would work it in a way that made sense, because I never wanted to have to explain the term.
You worked as a copywriter for many years prior to writing Becoming Bonnie. And that was another thing as far as erasing those lines. When you paint a painting, you draw a sketch, you erase those lines so that the person looking at and appreciating it doesn't see them. And I was fascinated by that when I saw you were a copywriter and that you were composing ads, because that takes a talent. That's a real skill. And specifically with the economy of words, things like using the proper nouns that you were just describing, translate that into fiction for us. How did those skills that you developed over those years come to help you in crafting Becoming Bonnie?
Well, I always saw my job as a copywriter almost putting puzzle pieces together in a way that a consumer would most engage with and appreciate and understand what I was trying to say. So I feel like a novel is rather similar, even though it's a different length of work, but a novel really is fitting all the pieces together in a way that's going to entertain the reader. And I think one element I took away from copywriting is that I wanted to use as few words as possible. And I knew I did my job right if I'm looking at a headline or an ad and I didn't have a ton of words. I was able to tell the story quickly and readers were able to understand it. So that was my purpose and my goal with writing my novels, is I want it to be condensed. I mean, there are some points where, especially with dialogue, I let myself use the slang a little bit and it can get a little wordier because I think when we talk, it does get wordier. So I wanted to remain true to the time period and what people could be saying. But otherwise, I wanted the pace to be fast and condensed and allow readers to kind of zip through the story and get the most of it.
I like that you really get to know Bonnie right away from that first scene, and also Roy. Roy occupies the first chunk of becoming Bonnie before Clyde crashes into her life, but you don't need that whole half to get to know her. When you see her sitting there, when you see her, I guess she's brushing her hair, she's just in her bedroom, here comes this bill that she doesn't want to have to pay, here she is looking at that line from the poem, and then Roy's asking her, why did you write it, why do you have it down? She tries to dodge him a little bit. That's all special, and I think that for people that are aspiring writers out there, learn to make every word justify itself, and you do that here in the dialogue, in using the slang, because you don't need a ton of words. My favorite example of that is the Beatles song, Eleanor Rigby. You go look at how many words, at some point I counted it up, but it's not that many words, and yet everybody knows what Eleanor Rigby looks like. It invokes everything about her entire life in that song. And when you say she puts on a face, she keeps in a jar by the door, everybody knows that. We don't need to know the color of the jar. We don't need to know what the makeup is. We don't even need to know something as basic as her race or what language she's speaking. We know who she is. And that's what this book was like. And that's why as a novel, it moves really fast. I picked it up and I said, okay, I'm going to read maybe half of it. First, I'm going to see if it grabs me, frankly. Then I'll read half because I don't want to give too much away, as I was talking about in the beginning. But you introduce us to her. She's the one we want to know. And then you also, at the same time, are building Roy into her life. And as a reader, maybe you want him to get out of the way. We know that he's not her destiny. And because he's not a famous person, I wonder how you decided to use him, how you dug up information about him to use in your plot, and if he helped you find your sea legs a little bit, this being your first novel, where he could fill in some of the blanks of real history with your imagination.
Yeah, it's funny that you use the word use as far as Roy, because I felt like as an author, I really did use him. Roy's purpose in the story is really to set up Bonnie's mindset, her heart, her emotions for when Clyde does come into the story later on. A lot of people actually don't know that Bonnie in real life had a marriage. Like, she was married to Roy, so she had a love prior to Clyde. And like you said, there isn't much known about Roy, but I did pick up some tidbits from diaries that Bonnie's little sister, Billy, had written, along with other anecdotes and stories that I was able to find. And it was interesting that at one time, Roy seemed like a good guy, and then he almost flipped the switch. And I saw that as a real opportunity to allow Bonnie to grow. So I wanted to make sure that in becoming Bonnie, I showed the full arc of Bonnie's relationship with Roy. And like I said, how it ultimately sets up her acceptance and willingness and almost eagerness to be with Clyde. So Roy's a very important element of the story, since his presence really builds Bonnie's character.
Another character that you mentioned earlier in becoming Bonnie is the friend Blanche. as a female author, I wonder if you approached her by infusing any of your relationships, your life experience into it. I guess it's a very basic thing for all authors to do, but when you have characters like this 100 years ago, a lot of it's myth. There's not a lot known about many of them. I wondered what you drew upon specifically for their dynamic. She's a little bit of the devil on this young church-going Bonnie's shoulder before she makes this big change throughout the narrative arc of your book. Did you do that? Or did you try to avoid anything that a friend of yours might recognize as themselves?
I think in this case, it's based on real life people. I didn't really allow my own personal life to seep in. Blanche, I will say I had plenty to work with based on who Blanche was as a person. She had written a memoir. And after reading Blanche's words and her reactions and her thought process, her voice just came to me hard and fast. And Blanche is actually a little bit of a deviation from history because she doesn't come into play until the 1930s when Bonnie and Clyde are out on their crime spree. But like I said, her voice was just inside my head and I couldn't get it out. And I wanted Blanche in Becoming Bonnie, even though that story is prior to the crime spree in the 1920s. So I ended up deviating and making Blanche Bonnie's childhood best friend because I needed Blanche there throughout both books, throughout Becoming Bonnie and then also the sequel, Being Bonnie. Yeah, Blanche is a very special character. I think readers are going to like her. And I've actually had people reach out to me saying that Blanche is by far their favorite. So that makes me happy because she's quite vivacious.
It's great for you that she has the perfect 20s name.
Yeah.
It's a really nice one. Makes you think right away. Invokes streetcar named Desire. Uh-huh. It was really good. So I didn't know at first until I started reading if you just created her for the book. But she really does seduce the reader, make you really feel fun, make you want to be the one pulling pranks with her, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's Blanche's purpose. She's the fun one who stretches Bonnie's boundaries and really makes Bonnie question who she is, what she wants, what she's going after. Blanche is a big catalyst in the novel. You got to watch out for Blanche because even though Blanche and Bonnie have a very important and tight relationship, Blanche is almost always looking out for herself. So she was a fun character to kind of show opposite of Bonnie, who begins very wholesome.
When I have novelists on, because it is different from a nonfiction book, I'd like to ask the author to read a little passage from the novel so we can get a flavor. Also, it's telling what the author chooses. So give us this clip here and set it up for us. Read us from Becoming Bonnie.
Yeah, so Becoming Bonnie is Bonnie's evolution story of how she becomes part of Bonnie and Clyde. So that essentially leads us to the point that Bonnie and Clyde eventually need to meet. And I make the reader wait a little bit for this official meeting, and I wanted to make it a very special moment. And what I'm about to read comes after Clyde reveals to Bonnie that he is into music and he had written her a song. And this is a very big allure for Bonnie because she's into music herself. So Clyde's about to reveal his music and his words for her. He runs a hand over the slight stubble on his chin and cheeks, and I scan the room further to distract myself. My gaze stops on the spine of a poetry book, then his guitar. You going to make good on your word and play for me? Clyde settles himself on the couch, then the instrument on his knee. He pats the spot beside him, pauses with his fingers ready to strum. I sit and fold my hands in my lap, watching as he clears his throat, swallows, clears his throat again. Clyde's head tilts down, and he looks up at me from under his lashes. I started this here song a while ago, but she ain't done, he says. Was hoping you'd help me finish her. Me? His fingertips slide down the strings once, letting the soft sound vibrate around us. You'll see. He goes back for more, a dark melody forming with each stroke, and moistens his lip. Clyde says more than sings. Death is a five-letter word with a five-finger clutch. His head stays down, his jaws relaxed, eyes closed. It cornered him, pitting him against the bigger man. By the throat, edging closer, nearing death's final touch. The rhythm quickens, the beat an unexpected surprise, Then there she was, light in the dark, defying death's plan. She stared it down, held on tight, fired off a shot all her own. Oh, he draws out the word, as if taunting death. Oh, 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 death for the boy has been postponed. Clyde's fingers shift to a higher pitch on the guitar. He smirks and sings from the corner of his mouth. Cause lean closer, listen close. How the story ends, no one knows. But one thing's clear, you'll see. Bonnie and Clyde meant to be alive and free. That last line, that last note hangs between us. I forget how to breathe. That's all I got for now, Clyde says softly. Thought maybe we could do the next verse together. Together? I wring my hands, staring into the eyes of Clyde Barrow. The criminal, the charmer, the boy who wrote me a doggone song to show me how he cares. Yeah, Bonnie, you and me, what do you say?
When you hear the name Clyde Barrow, you don't think of a musician. And I think it's a perfect way to go about this relationship. We're really remembering that they're not just two people mushed together like a musical duo. There's a point where one person ends and the other begins. There's a point where they meet. There's a different dynamic there. And to invoke music in a novel also is involving all the senses, which is another sign of good writing. Something you always want to do is titillate all of the senses, get everything in play, smell, taste, sight. And in this case, the heart, you're feeling emotions there. You're seeing her. She's had this marriage. She's had this trouble with Roy. She's had a life that's very much cast about. And there she is, somebody writing a song for her. She's somebody who, from the very first moment we meet her, loves poetry. So this really shows, it makes you see, it's not a case where we look at couples sometimes and say, what do they possibly see in each other? That makes that link really tight right there. And we can understand why they're together. In fact, we don't even ask the question. It's just they're meant to be.
Yeah, I love that. I really wanted to show Bonnie and Clyde as a partnership. And what Clyde was referencing in those words in his song was that there's a moment where earlier in the book, Bonnie saves him. And then there's another moment where he saves her. So they really are loyal and devoted to each other. And I wanted to make that very strong for readers so it was believable. The strongest thing I wanted to accomplish was for my characters to be relatable. Like, you may not agree with their decisions, and I think 99% of people will not agree with their decisions, but I wanted them to make sense.
You're enjoying my 20s style jawing with Jenny L. Walsh. See, unlike the author, I'm free to be as corny as I want with all the 20s sounding jargon. Her novel is Becoming Bonnie. It's her debut novel, and it's hitting shelves just in time for the 50th anniversary of the Oscar award-winning film Bonnie and Clyde. You can visit her online at jennylwalsh.com or follow her on that Twitter account at Jenny L. Walsh. That's Jenny with an I. Booklist writes of Becoming Bonnie, quote, Walsh's debut historical novel brings the Prohibition era, the Great Depression, and American gangsters to life through the personality and circumstances of a notorious moll who starts out as a good girl. Although the story focuses on Bonnie, supporting characters provide further perspectives on the magnetic pull of jazz, illegal booze, and a short life on the lam. Jenny, it struck me in that review that your debut as a novelist is a book that focuses on Bonnie's debut as a gangster's moll. It always is fun to talk about how reality matches dreams. In this case, not Bonnie's dreams and Bonnie's reality, but your own. Describe the ride you've taken so far with Becoming Bonnie as a first-time author. How does the reality of doing interviews like this or going on the road, doing book signings, having people interact with you on Twitter and tell you what they think about your book as you've let it walk on its own out into the world, match up with what you thought it would be like when you were toiling away, munching your Swedish fish and started trying to write it?
It was a long road for me to get here, and I guess I wasn't quite sure what to expect. I had written previous novels before Becoming Bonnie. They just weren't published. So this is actually my fourth book that I've completed, and like I said, the first to be published. So I was very anxious to get to this point, but I was also nervous for those elements you mentioned of book tours and speaking about the story, because I'm very much a homebody and an introvert, and I'm happy with my nose in a book or writing my novels. And I guess I didn't expect to enjoy talking to others about the book as much as I do. I mean, of course, it's fun when people tell me they love the book, and people could say that all day. I'll listen all day. But I really just enjoy answering questions and talking about the time period and talking about Bonnie and Clyde, because Bonnie and Clyde really surprised me as individuals. I didn't realize how deep they both ran besides these criminals and outlaws. And I think that's one of the things I wanted to come across within Becoming Bonnie and the sequel Being Bonnie, is they had a lot of dreams and aspirations and motivations for what they were doing and how they were doing it. So I think, like I said, that I think the biggest surprise for me is just how fun all of this is. And I'm very fortunate to be an author and tell these stories.
You said you were surprised by how deep they both run. What was that origin moment for you that made you think you wanted to live inside Bonnie's head for all this time and tell your version of her origin story?
It's interesting because Bonnie wasn't necessarily on my radar. My husband and I were brainstorming what I wanted to write about. And I knew I wanted to do historical fiction because that's typically what I read. And I enjoy that. And I knew I wanted to do an iconic figure because I personally have a draw to those inspired by or based on stories. So I had my checklist of what I wanted to hit. And my husband's a very big history buff. So we were throwing some different names and situations back and forth. And I can't remember who had mentioned Bonnie and Clyde, but their name came up. And what I recalled about them was from the 1967 film. And it had been years since I've actually seen the film, like maybe at that point, 10 or 15 years. And I couldn't remember the details about Bonnie and Clyde's spree or even their life. But what I could recall was this devotion and loyalty they had to, like, toward each other. And I was so curious what made them tick and what was the catalyst for that devotion and why Bonnie was willing to leave her life and her family behind for somebody like Clyde Barrow. So I think I just wanted to understand who they were as people and their psyches. And that's what really inspired me to want to tell Bonnie's story, especially after I dug deeper and saw that she started as a very wholesome young girl. She, like I mentioned earlier, she went to church and she sang at church. She was a straight A student. She was in spelling bees, which she won, and talent shows and beauty pageants. So I was just wondering, how do you go from that to somebody whose life ends in an ambush?
That film, Bonnie and Clyde, starring Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty, turns 50 this year, which is perfect timing for Becoming Bonnie. I wondered how fans have felt, if you've heard from any of them at this early date in the novel's life. How do they feel about Becoming Bonnie, and how do you regard the film portrayal? Did you watch it a bunch of times, or did you stay away from it because you wanted to have your own voice and have your own take on Bonnie that was separate from this image on the screen?
Yeah, I haven't heard from anybody yet about the film in relation to my novel. I would be completely honored if somebody enjoyed my book as much as they enjoyed the film, because it's, you know, a very award-winning and iconic film. I personally haven't seen the film since my teenage years, and I want to watch it. Like, I'm desperately eager to watch it again just to see how their story matches up to my own, because I know that the film has taken creative license. So I wanted to see where we align just creatively. But because the film does take those creative licenses, that's the reason why I haven't watched it yet, because I didn't want anything to influence my storyline or my thoughts. I just wanted to go where my characters were leading me.
So you still can't watch it because you're not done with the sequel?
I am currently writing the sequel, so okay. I will watch it soon. I'm actually planning an event with a local film theater, and they're going to screen the film later in the year for me, and have some people come in and we can talk about the book and the film and stuff. So I'm really excited for that.
Bonnie Parker, by the way, speaking of creative license, doesn't start out life in real life with the name Bonnellan. How do you feel about the fact that as Becoming Bonnie enjoys wide success, readers are going to start folding your creation into the myth of Bonnie and Clyde and just assuming that that was her real first name? That has to be a charge for you as an author if and when that happens.
Yeah, it's funny. I never thought about that until I was at a signing the other day and someone did think her name really was Bonnellyn. And I kind of had a moment where I was like, oh, wow. Yeah, I guess I did change her name and didn't realize that people were going to think it was reality. But yeah, I wanted the novel to start with Bonnie having a very wholesome sounding name to just really show her evolution as a character. And Clyde is the one who actually starts calling her Bonnie. So everything about this book is her evolution. So yes, she starts as Bonnellyn, and I think I would just be tickled if people almost think it's part of the myth of Bonnie and Clyde. I think it'd be a fun little nod to the book.
It seems like it because she's so vivid. You've painted a really vivid character. And so then when it starts to get folded in, and already in this case, it's the fun thing about historical fiction. It's what I love about it. It is just something that gets you hooked on the history of it. It's kind of a sweet way to read it. And you say, well, gee, maybe after I read this book on Bonnie and Clyde, I read Becoming Bonnie, I want to learn some more of the real history of the 20s. And it's a way to get you back to that period that you might not touch otherwise. You might not be a serious history reader. And from this perspective of you saying your husband is into the hard history, was the 20s a period that you both always liked? Did you read a lot about it before you went into research Bonnie's life, or was that something you had to do from scratch for writing Becoming Bonnie and then being Bonnie?
I've always been intrigued by the 1920s. So I was excited about the opportunity to write during that era. But it's interesting because when I first started to tell Bonnie's origin story, I started in the 1930s when they were going out onto their crime spree. But I got a couple chapters into telling the story, and I realized that I was taking some leaps with the reader, and I was expecting the reader to almost just accept Bonnie's mindset and her thoughts and her actions without ever setting them up or showing how her actions were plausible. And in that moment, I realized that I needed to back up and tell Bonnie's story prior to her leaving on her crime spree. Because it really wasn't adding up for me. And if it wasn't adding up for me as the author, then I couldn't expect readers to believe it. So it was almost this moment of good fortune where when I backed up, I ended up backing up all the way to 1927 into the height of the Roaring Twenties. So it was a very exciting moment for me where I was like, yes, now I get to put Bonnie in a speakeasy and yeah, show jazz music and show her up on stage singing and bring this really exciting part of our history to life. I tried to be a very visual author, so just the idea of the Roaring Twenties was so fun for me. And the time period is very interesting because by 1929, we have a stock market crash. So in Becoming Bonnie, I'm able to begin the novel with excitement and vibrance and that Great Gatsby feel. But toward the end of the novel, we have the stock market crash and things are somber and darker, and then the beginning of the Great Depression. So I was able to have a very strong contrast between the beginning and the end of the book. And that was fun for me to tackle as an author.
And you're able to set yourself up for the sequel, Being Bonnie, and have two books which enable you to tell such a wide sweep of history. It's not as if this is two books that are set in the same time. Did you originally intend to write a sequel, or is that something that came to you later?
Yeah, that came to me later. Like I said, I had originally just sought out to tell the crime spree story, and it was almost a surprise to me when I told Bonnie's origin story. So I was very much hoping I would get to continue and finish their story. And when my publisher gave me the green light to work on the sequel, I very excitedly dove in and began to bring that story to life. While Becoming Bonnie stretches from 1927 to 1929, Being Bonnie is a tighter time period. It's the 22 months that they're out on the run leading this life of the lamb. So I think we see a contrast between this second book and the first book in the setting and Bonnie's thoughts and their actions and her desperation. So there's a very strong contrast between the two books. And I think we'll see that even in the covers. I haven't seen the cover yet, but we've been brainstorming a little bit. And I think they're going to really mimic the stories very well.
I'm probably not alone in being spoiled with instant entertainment in this current world where we have binge watching, which you wouldn't have had back in the 1960s, for instance, with Star Trek. They didn't notice the viewers back then that guys with red shirts were always going to die because they were watching them all spaced out. And if you missed it, you missed it. There wasn't a VHS. There certainly wasn't a DVR. So with that in mind, how long will we have to wait until Being Bonnie hits the shelves?
I do not have an exact date yet, but I think it's going to be May of 2018.
I have one final question for you, and it goes back to the very first page of the book before Bonnie begins telling her story. The dedication of Becoming Bonnie features a picture of a slip of paper from a fortune cookie. The fortune reads, "Believe it can be done," and someone scribbled on it, "This was meant for you, XOXO. What's the story behind that fortune? And can you tell us what made you think to use it right there at the front of the book?
Yeah, so my husband and I love Chinese food, and we always read our fortunes. And he actually pulled the fortune, "Believe it can be done." And he didn't say anything at the time. We kind of just talk about our fortunes or laugh about them, and we kind of just push them aside, and we don't really see them again. But my husband saved his fortune, "Believe it can be done." And I found it the next morning on my laptop when I got up to work, and he had scribbled on it, "This was meant for you." And it was a very touching moment for me because we have two young children. We have a one-year-old and a three-year-old. And my husband has really helped out tremendously to pretty much do every single domestic task possible in the house. We normally try to split things, but for the past couple years, he's been doing majority of the work. And on the weekends, he's been Mr. Mom doing pretty much all the childhood stuff so that I can make this dream a reality. So I wanted to make sure that I gave him credit for all that he's done to allow this moment for me, which was such a special moment for me to have. So yes, I started the dedication with that fortune cookie that he left for me on my computer.
Well, I'll speak for all the readers who enjoy Becoming Bonnie as much as I did and say we appreciate it too, because this was a fun ride. It doesn't sound like we would have been able to take without him picking up some of the slack around the house. So we definitely appreciate that. I appreciate you coming today to share the novel with us, giving a little behind the scenes view of how you made that dream a reality. Thanks so much for joining us to share this fictionalized story of the woman people are now calling Bonnilyn all over and will continue to for many years in the future. It's a tribute to how vivid your portrait is, that it's sticking in readers' minds. And I really hope people will check it out online, see if it's your cup of tea. The 20s is such a vibrant and exciting time, super fun to read about. Best of luck with Becoming Bonnie, and we'll look forward to Being Bonnie in 2018.
Thank you so much.
Again, the novel is Becoming Bonnie. As always, you can find the Amazon link to purchase your copy at historyauthor.com. And we hope you will click through there, or even navigate through the Amazon banner on our homepage the next time you purchase anything from Amazon. Say you want to get yourself a silver hip flask like all the malls and flappers had. Well, you go to our website, we take you to Amazon, and Amazon.com gives us a small percentage of every dollar you spend at no additional charge in your shopping cart. For just a few extra clicks, you can help us keep the flux capacitor on our time machine humming like usual. My thanks to Jenny L. Walsh for joining us and for giving us the origin story of Bonnie Parker as she imagines it, while inspiring all first-time novelists to believe in their fortune cookies. They really can do it. Remember to visit Jenny with an I at jennylwalsh.com and follow her at Jenny L. Walsh on Twitter. And while you're at it, let us know what you think of the book and the interview on Twitter at HistoryDean or facebook.com/historyauthor. That's it for this installment of the History Author Show. I hope you'll join us for next Monday's all-new interview right here on iHeartRadio. And if you're an iTunes subscriber, please take a minute to leave us a review. Well, until our next trip into the past together, thanks so much for time traveling with us today, and have a swell week.
We still call it Broadway, but what's in a name? Take it from Georgie, it isn't the same. On the east side, west side, things ain't like before. There are tears in the eyes of the regular.